You're listening to Thinking Out Loud. We're coming to you from the University of Massachusetts Lowell. This is WUML 91.5 FM. We've got an interesting show today, and we've got a guest, an old friend of mine. This is Dan Toomey, by the way, and his name is Chuck Levenstein, a professor here at the university, recently retired, and he's also a poet, and I think you'll find him very interesting. So with no further ado, we'll go on to the show. And on Thursdays for the last year or so, we've been doing a series of interviews with local artists, poets, and writers. And so today we've got an old friend of mine, Chuck Levenstein, who's a retired professor, just retired, been a professor here at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. He's going to tell you a little bit about that. And since he's retired, he's taken back up one of his loves, and that's poetry. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today, and a little bit about why somebody is interested in poetry, I guess. So mm-hmm. Chuck, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm enjoying being a man of leisure.
Yeah. Well, I've been retired since 1991 from the fire department, but I've been working ever since.
No, the only thing I'm not doing now is teaching. I've been active in various occupational health and safety efforts in the Massachusetts area. That is what I was teaching in the work environment department. So the only thing I'm not doing is teaching.
Yeah, but you were key in beginning the work in the environment department, I'm sure.
Yes, I was one of the first people to come to UMass, or to ULowell at the time, to start the department, and have been here, was here for years after that.
And a great advocate for worker health and safety, for sure.
Yes.
So, you did that for a number of years, and now you're doing a lot of things, still involved in the health and safety field, but you've decided to do some poetry, and so tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, I had started writing when I was a kid, and probably saved the world from awful stuff by burning everything every 10 years. So, and then, at one point I decided that I would have to make a living, and being a poet was not a great way to make a living. So I finished up a doctorate in economics, and didn't realize how much of your creativity and your time and your energy that being an economist and being an academic would take. So I sort of had a day job that overtook everything else, and being an economist surpassed being a poet. So as I moved toward retirement, I got more involved with writing again and trying to figure out what I had to say. That was not about science. That was about a way about knowing things and sharing things and understanding things that dipped into my perceptions and other people's lives in a way that you couldn't really do with scientific work. So I started writing poems again. I guess the first thing that happened was, the internet helped a lot, because the internet sort of helps you to go public very fast, and whatever writing I had done was sort of secret. I was like an Emily Dickinson with a working class background in my room, and just scribbling. But the internet sort of takes you out, and I needed a workshop in which to talk with other people about writing poems, and so I went online. And it was okay, because it was late at night, early in the morning, and I could talk with other people who were struggling with how to make poems. So I wrote for some time that way, basically never telling anybody about it. At some point, I met Paul Marion, who was here at the university, and we talked about writing, and he and I talked about doing a small book. So Loom Press, which Paul is the editor of, ended up putting out a small collection, 45, 50 pages, of a book called Lost Baggage, which is a collection of my poems. Lost Baggage mainly because I've done a lot of international work. I've traveled a lot. And a lot of the times, and I had time to write then, was when I was alone in a hotel someplace, or I was, you know, hanging out waiting for a meeting, or in between meetings, or coming back from visiting a factory. So that's what this is collected from. You know, let me read some for you, give you an idea of what I've been doing.
Okay.
I mean, a couple of these poems are from that book, and then I'll read some stuff later stuff. But this poem was written sort of in reaction to the beautiful young people who are poets who write about love and beauty and the like. And so this is called The Poetic Life. This is not a life of butterflies. There's not a sunny poem on my desk. Poems of pain, a snapshot of Mexican child workers, of struggle, Worcester nurses striking, poems about the Vietnamese boy in Chelsea who lost his hand in a printing press after one day on the job, about tunnel workers who died breathless under Boston Harbor, the violinist who can no longer play, the textile worker who cannot lift her child, the good old boy who sleeps with four pillows in order to breathe and has no sex. The materials of poetry, dusts and fumes, asbestos, pesticides, a modern toxic stew, the ergonomics of poetry, the back, the neck, the arms, the hands, the brains, the soul, the gristmill's daily grind, the machinery of poetry. There are blue skies, sex, and grandchildren, but the poetic life is one of attention, not of beauty.
And you have a lot of personal experience that went into that poetry.
I have grandchildren, I have sex, yes, they are.
No, and you also, you know, but you also yeah. did a lot of research and interaction with people in factories, people who were injured on the job, and you did a lot of work here at the university training people to help us overcome some of those things.
Well, look, my father was an electrician and a trade unionist. His union sent me to college. That's why I am not an electrician. So they sent me to the university, and I ended up feeling that I had some obligations to blue-collar workers and to the working class, and that in some way I should use the education that I got to improve conditions for workers. And when I first got out of university, I worked for trade unions, and then I went back to school to do the economics degree. It seemed to me that that is what I know about, and it's where my loyalties lie, and it's what I write about. Some. I mean, I am somebody else. I also live the life of an academic, and I'm in the university, and but yes, I mean, I write a lot of, I've done a book about brown lung, the cotton mill workers' lung disease. I edit a journal that is about workers' health and safety that I do with the paper allied chemical and industrial workers. Yes, that's both of those things. I do both of those things.
But your poetry isn't just words, you know. Your poetry that I'm hearing here is about things that you really feel and have experienced.
Yes.
Let's hear some more.
Okay, well, one of the other things I decided I needed to do was to take a Spanish class, because I really wanted to... I had learned Spanish when I was a kid, but I wanted to learn some more. So I took a course, and this is about sort of... This is called Spanish Lessons, but it's about my Spanish teacher. Each person's suffering is unique. Each victim is alone. Each war is like no others. Each loss, no matter how excruciatingly similar, no matter how boring is the telling, even worse the listening, each tale is like a leaden bullet loaded into the victim's gun and fired with no thought of the chain of evidence. Glossary. Narcotraficante. Escobar. Medellin. Bombs and assassins all paid for in one way or another by the Estados Unidos and its self-indulgent citizens, destroyed my Spanish teacher's city, her family of lawyers and economistas are scattered to corners of the earth. This has happened never before and will never again. Noticias, this all started because a six-year-old in Michigan brought a gun to the school and shot a classmate. It continued because the new student in the class was from Beirut. Then came the bombs. End of 5 years of tears. I am the strongest woman in the world, she said, because of her family, the strength of her family ties, and 6 years of counseling and Prozac. The Spanish teacher talked without hope of being understood because none of us could understand, No one of us could have lived through what she lived through, but she did not ask us, and she had the advantage because she speaks Spanish very well, and we can only stutter through our suffering, which even if we were much more articulate would be boring, the suffering of all time. To blame. The policies of the American government, better than holding God accountable, although not much better. Still, the Inocentes expected something better, but I really don't understand why. Someday I will tell her about Murder Incorporated and Batlin Abe Kahn if I want to get historical or more recent tragedies. But I am sick of this mass of grief, this stone of depression. Why must my Spanish be flavored with tears when there is still another day?
It's wonderful. The name of the book is Lost Baggage, and it's poems by Charles Levenstein. Everybody calls him Chuck.
Right.
And it's in Loom Press. How do people get hold of this?
Well, you know, Paul Marion has it, and I have it. So, and the bookstore here, at, Barnes & Noble bookstore here had it. Also, uh-huh. I don't know, they probably still do, because I don't think they're selling it, uh-huh. as though there's nothing.
Yeah.
More?
Yeah.
Okay. This is called Merrimack River Rhapsody, and it was published in the Bridge Review, which is the UMass Lowell's I guess it's not a quarterly. It comes out every couple of years. This is from Bridge Review, number 4. It's called Merrimack River Rhapsody. A grandmother stands in the street in the old Irish acre. Her hair is protected from the icy rain by a babushka donated to the Salvation Army. On her feet are plastic flip-flops. She reminds my friend of his old Greek grandmother, a peasant lady swept to the New World by wars and poverty. The bewilderment on her face is the same. How did I come from the fields of Cambodia to this cold, gray place? We contemplate time and sip chicken egg lemon soup at the Olympia, decide on moussaka and tomato-stained potato, Diet Coke and ice. This city is washed by a human flood in every generation. Women fish and gossip by the edge of the river. Teenagers sample the water, are taught the tenets of environmental justice. The men stamp out plastic parts indispensable to the American imagination.
And so you talked about economic justice, environmental justice, I'm sorry.
Sure.
And you're also involved in the peace and justice movement, as a number of us are.
Here. Yeah, sure. I mean, these are not political things. These are just, it's life. That's what you do in your life when you're concerned about every day and talking to people and living with people. It's not politics.
We're both from New York City.
Yeah.
So we talk a little funny.
Yeah.
Both from, the western part of Long Island.
Right. I'm from Queens. You're from Brooklyn.
That's right.
Yes, right.
And I was 20-something years old before I realized that I lived on Long Island.
Right. Right. I guess that's true. We both lived on Long Island.
Yeah.
I thought that was where the rich people lived.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's what we all thought. Well, anyway, you know, your dad was from...
Oh, my dad was born in Latvia and emigrated in 1905, I think. Basically, they were trying to kill Jews in Latvia at the time, and the family got out. And so he came here as a child. My mother came from Ukraine in 1901.
Uh-huh. First Lower East Side first, or what?
Well, my father came to the Lower East Side, and he ended up meeting my mother because he got drafted. He got drafted, got sent back to Europe, fought in France, met an uncle from Philadelphia, and he was going. His girlfriend in Philadelphia was my mother's sister. So when they came back to the States, my uncle invited him to Philadelphia, and that's how they met. So my mother got to the seventh grade. She was the more educated of the two, but at the time she worked in a bank. I guess you could do that then. So she liked my father. Got through the third grade, but was able to become an electrician in those days. Advanced technology. He wore frameless glasses. She thought he was an intellectual. They went to see Hamlet together in Yiddish, and loved each other. So they moved to New York, and the rest, just happened. I have three older brothers, and I was born in 1938. And the thing that was on my brother said to me, the most important thing about it is my father got his first job in 6 years and went on the day I was born. So I was good luck. I was after the Depression.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you've had vast experience. You've been all over the world.
Yeah.
As part of your position here, as a professor in the mm-hmm. Work Environment Department, but also you were chair of the department?
No. I was the head of the policy component of the department, but I was never chair.
Okay, but you went all over the world to mm-hmm. take a look at working conditions?
Yes.
Unions, right. Health and safety issues?
Well, I got started traveling really not until the 1980s. And in 1982, I led a group with Margaret Quinn, who's on the faculty here, to China. And we were the first group of Americans who, in occupational health and safety, who visited China after the Cultural Revolution. The Cultural Revolution was finished. We went over to see what conditions were, and we visited 5 cities, got a look at China, which I think was amazing and an important one. And we made good friends. And I got a taste for doing international work then because I discovered that here were a group of public health scientists who had been in China, who had been sent off into the countryside and had been abused in many, many ways. Some of them had really badly abused. Nevertheless, when it was time, they came back and they continued their work, and they were committed to worker health and safety and to public health, and they picked it up. And they said, I learned a lot about working on a farm, while I was away, shoveling, there. So I was knocked out by that. I felt like I was participating in an international community of people who were committed to worker health and safety.
And then you've been to South and Central America.
Yeah, I've been to Brazil a number of times. And I've been working with people there, and I've had students from Mexico, and I've been down to Mexico.
Europe, Eastern Europe too.
Mainly Eastern Europe, but from 1990 on, basically in order to find out what the big changes were, what the change meant in Eastern Europe for workers' health and safety. We went there, we organized the conference in Hungary, and then out of that, annually, a conference came that was moved around Central Europe mainly. We were in Poland, Bulgaria, Czech and Slovakia, Slovenia. We recruited some students, we developed some friends there. It was important work, and now we've set up a center in Glasgow, the European Center for Occupational Health, Safety and Environment, which continues that work. And the people here at Lowell said our real efforts and commitments should be in the Americas, so we're trying to do a similar thing in Latin America. So we had one meeting in Mexico, and then about a year and a half later, we went to Brazil, had another major conference, really. And this February will be the third conference on the Observatory of the Americas, it's called, and that will be in Costa Rica. Eduardo Siqueira, who's a research faculty member here, is the key person who's pulling that together. It's exciting. It's important work to make the links in the Americas. I'm sort of done with that. I mean, Eduardo is doing that, and other people here are doing that. I've started a seminar on Africa, which is an inter-university seminar on Africa. We're meeting monthly to start to think about what we might do in Africa. So I don't know. Maybe something will come out of this.
Also. But all the places that you've gone, you must have been too busy to really sit down and write poetry about it. Now you've got a chance to take all of those experiences and put them into another form that people can enjoy in a different way.
Well, let me give you another.
Okay.
All right. This is a birthday poem when I turned 65. Right. So I could walk dogs in the morning. Small ones, 2 or 3 at a time, carry a shovel in a big plastic bag, maybe 2, the other for cans and bottles, not that I need a shopping cart, no need to wander or beg, just to stay amused. I could pack groceries at the organic store, chat with bony ladies and tattooed children, grin at the Russian emigres after 20 years, still wonderstruck by the supermarket. I could sell flavored water to runners, unscented deodorant to the sensitive, coconut massage oil to the sensuous, free-range boneless breasts without skin, triple cream cheeses from France or Pennsylvania, I could eye other old men who love nature and the false promise of spandex. I could canvass for peace or the Heart Association, raise money for and against cancer. I could ring a bell or two to horn at Christmas, get into fistfights with ex-priests who picket abortion clinics. I could smoke marijuana, hand out flyers to legalize drugs, go to town meeting to protest scabs at the latest luxury structure still under construction or the parking spaces that will sell for $65,000 each. I learned the price from equipment operators who like to chat on their break. I could be an elderly spy. I could write poems such as Solitary Game unless I went to workshops in Concord or on the Cape, hung out in bars and bistros, read at open readings until discovered and won the Pulitzer, became poet laureate of Samoa, published in translation in obscure languages, chanted at Naropa, had my picture taken naked in a diner or with Susan Sarandon. On another errand of mercy, the senior center at Temple Beth Shalom, which, without irony, displays a sign supporting Israel in its pursuit of peace, I could write poems, walk dogs, pack groceries, canvas, and fight.
So that must have been an interesting birthday, eh?
Yes, it was a good birthday. It was a good birthday.
That was last year.
That was, yeah, I'm 66 now. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, we're right. The same age, by the way.
Is that right?
Yeah. So anyway, we're talking with Chuck Levenstein. Chuck is a retired professor from the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Chuck has a long career in the health and safety field. Was a professor in the Work Environment Department here at the university. Chuck's retired now, and he's writing poetry and doing a number of other things by the sound of it. So I want to thank you for being on the show, Chuck.
Great.
And love to have you back.
Love to come.
Okay, cool.
Be fun.
All right. You're listening to Thinking Out Loud. This is Dan Toomey.